Hi, I'm Mikey, and I just turned 11, and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's Almost Above Ground Audio Magazine. Great show, Dad.
That's Mikey Steven, my son, who just turned 11 yesterday. Mikey, happy birthday, buddy. We love you. Oh, boy, it is flying by, and he's giving off middle school vibes, isn't he? Oh, boy. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's Almost Above Ground Audio Magazine. I am Mike Steven. It's great to be here with you today for show number 1014. And what we do here on the program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. The great Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty today in the WGN radio studio. Boy, what a week. You got Mikey's birthday in there. Also, St. Patty's Day. And we had a primary election here in Illinois. And did you see this? Raja Krishnamoorthy, who was running for Senate on the Democratic side, he had, you know, a big election night party, as all the candidates do. His was held at the Westin on Michigan Avenue in downtown Chicago. And apparently, if you wanted to buy, let's say, a beer at that party, first of all, you had to buy it. It would cost you $15.34. If you wanted water, it was $12.85 for water. 12 bucks, almost 13 bucks. Wine was $21.87. If you're having a cash bar, okay, this is just for all you future politicians out there. If you're having a cash bar at your election night party, you might as well get out of politics. What are you doing? You can't do that. You got enough money in your campaign fund. As Gregory Pratt, the reporter, tweeted, Krishnamoorthy spent more than $20 million on that Senate seat, and he lost. He couldn't afford a cash bar for the election night party. Come on. Maybe it's best that things work out the way that they do. And also our friend Mr. Chicago Bars on Twitter said, what's going on with the Westin beverage director who couldn't figure out how to set prices to end in even amounts after tax? Oh, man. All right. Well, yeah, stuff works out the way it's supposed to. Politicians don't have cash bars at your election night parties. What are you doing? I'll tell you what we're doing. A great show for you today. And no cash bars here. Life in prisons is difficult, and often there are gaps in healthcare access, especially mental health treatment. The John Howard Association is a Chicago-based independent oversight organization of prison systems and works to promote humane treatment and increased transparency in prisons. They have a new report out this month called Untapped Potential: The Power of Peer Support Programs in Prisons. Jennifer Volen-Katz is the executive director of the John Howard Association. They are online at thejha.org, and she is here with us today once again on Outside the Loop. Jenny, nice to talk to you again. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. So we're talking about life in prisons again here, and your organization does such a really important job and such a good job of really shining a light on what's going on the other side of those prison walls, because as we've talked about, it is not always easy to get a clear sense of what's happening inside of these prisons. So can you give us a sense, based off of your research here, what is that disparity of healthcare treatment like in our prisons today?
So for many years, the John Howard Association has documented, and frankly, many groups have litigated, the quality of healthcare available to people who are incarcerated, as well as mental health care and treatment for mental illness available to people who are incarcerated in Illinois. And, you know, it is not a secret that there is very little treatment provided, and the quality of that treatment is incredibly problematic. So we have issues with access to care, quality of care. Currently, we're experiencing a huge rate of vacancies when it comes to medical staffing positions inside our prisons. And so the people inside continue to suffer from lack of care. And it is something that's deeply troubling and should worry everybody, because prison health is public health.
That's right. And as we've talked about, sometimes with regards to prisons, it's out of sight, out of mind, but this is a public health issue. And so there's a serious need for care in prisons. And from what we're hearing here, and this, you kind of dive into this in the report, is things aren't necessarily getting better. Things are getting worse. So this brings us to this peer support program. What are these peer support programs and how do they work?
So this was a really unusual piece of work for us at the John Howard Association, and really exciting, quite frankly. So often our work focuses on pointing out the deficiencies in the system, the problems, the suffering we witness on a regular basis when we're inside prisons doing monitoring visits. And often, you know, our work revolves around pointing out deficiencies and problems. And we don't get a chance to look for broad-based solutions where community can really help community. So understanding a correctional environment, I think, is an important piece to putting forward viable solutions that will improve lives inside our prisons. And this opportunity really gave us a chance to do that. We started with the premise that we know there are a lot of needs going unmet inside our prisons and that that causes a lot of harm to people. And the question became, how can community help community inside a carceral environment? And our research quickly led us to peer support programs that are available in other jurisdictions, how they're run, what they do, the impact they have. And we had the opportunity to not only dig deep into these programs and understand the benefits, but actually go to other jurisdictions and experience them up and running. And it was incredibly eye-opening, and the impact that these programs had, not just on the participants, you know, meaning the people who provide the peer support and those who receive the support, but really on everybody inside the facility, was remarkable.
So with a peer support group, this is someone or a group of people who are incarcerated and they go through this special training. And what do they do in a peer support group? How does it work?
So there are different models and different programs that focus, you know, some more general, some more specifically on particular kinds of needs. The programs we saw were a little bit more broader based, and in many ways, I'd put them in the category of mental health support. And particularly the one in Wisconsin was focused on training the peer support specialists, and they do receive a state certification to be peer supporters to help provide mentorship to people struggling in a carceral environment. And that could look like a variety of different things. It could be adjustment to prison life, which is very different than life on the outside. Mm-hmm. Or it could be people with unmet mental health needs who were, you know, who are spiraling. And while these people are not clinicians and not mental health professionals, by virtue of having similar lived experience and understanding some of the circumstances that might be triggering or exacerbating mental health issues for other people in custody, you know, had the ability to provide really effective de-escalation and support to those individuals. So sometimes it's more specific to a particular medical or mental health issue or even skill-based. But what we saw was really around emotional well-being and mental health support.
And the effectiveness of this, you know, I think this is such an amazing thing because, again, it and so much of what you do and your research and your documentation here, I think really challenges the notion of how we might think of prison systems in this country and what goes on inside of them. Because for so many of us, we just don't know. So I want to ask you, what are the outcomes of this? How effective are these programs?
Yeah, from what we saw and what we learned, and some of these programs have had outside evaluations conducted, which is really remarkable. And all of the evidence indicates that these are really successful programs. And one of the things that really struck me is in speaking to the people who are the peer support specialists who provide the support, so many of them talked about the meaning that this brought to their lives, that it was a way to give back. They recognized past mistakes. They did not shy away from talking about their histories and the mistakes that they had made, but they talked about how meaningful it was to them to be given an opportunity to provide help, to provide support, to do something positive. Many of them, and I think this is also truly remarkable, believe so deeply in these programs and in the support they're providing and the value of it that they will, against self-interest, they will give up privileges in order to go to facilities and provide support to people in need because they believe this program is so important, that the integrity of it is so critical to maintain that integrity is so critical that they will leave a lower security facility to go to like a maximum security facility, even though they don't have to be there, give up the privileges that come from being in a lower security facility in order to go and be a peer mentor, a specialist to the people who are in need, where they know that that support is deeply needed. That's how deeply they believe in the program. That is how motivated to give back they are. And we heard the same thing over and over from the people who provide the support, the people who receive the support, and all of the correctional administrators and staff who are involved in the program, which is this changes things. It changes not only individuals on both sides of the equation, but the culture inside the facility. And there was a lot of data that they had collected that demonstrated, you know, that violence indicators were way down. The number of people experiencing mental health crises was way down. We had staff talk to us about situations where somebody had put themselves, a person who was incarcerated, had put themselves in serious peril, threatening to self-harm. And when staff was unsuccessful in being able to de-escalate the situation, they called in a peer mentor who was able to successfully help the individual de-escalate and step down from the dangerous situation because they understood that person's lived experience and they were able to connect with them emotionally in a way that was different and frankly, more impactful for the person who was in the crisis situation. So the benefits are myriad. And it was really amazing to hear that really from everybody who is involved in, you know, touched, impacted by these programs in any way inside of a prison.
It's really amazing what's going on here with these peer support programs. And we can check out the entire report. It's called Untapped Potential: The Power of Peer Support Programs in Prisons. It's up on the John Howard Association website, thejha.org. And Jennifer Vollen-Katz is the executive director of that Chicago-based independent oversight organization working to promote humane treatment and increased transparency in prisons. Jenny, I always appreciate your time and all of your hard work that you and everybody over at the John Howard Association is doing, because this is really a vital issue that we should continue to monitor. So thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your interest in the work that we do.
Let's talk about some local music on the show this week, coming from the Meadowlark Lemons. We can check them out online, meadowlarklemons.com. Their record release show, the self-titled record, the big debut record, that's happening this Friday at Fitzgerald's in Berwyn. And Chris Neville is the vocalist. He plays keys in the Meadowlark Lemons. Chris, welcome to Outside the Loop.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
You got it. It is great talking with you. I've seen you a bunch because I'm a big fan of one of your other projects, Tributosaurus, and oh, yeah. You guys have played for a long time and many, many places, so I can vouch for you that you're good. If anyone's wondering, is this guy any good? Chris is very good, I can tell you that.
I appreciate that.
You got it, man. So let's talk about this music with the Meadowlark Lemons. I am a sucker for it. I love this stuff because you've got the funk in there. You've got some soul. How do you think of this music? What's your approach?
You know, I mean, I think that's a pretty good description. It's a it's kind of a combination of funk and soul. There's definitely some New Orleans flavor to a lot of it. But the roots are in Chicago, and that's kind of the sound that we have, not necessarily because we were chasing it, but because that's just what comes out when we play. So
sure. And when I listened to it, and I know you actually mentioned this on the website, but when I heard the first few tracks, and then when you get deeper into the record, I'm like, oh, this is the Meters, man. I hear the Meters in there. Yes, Booker T and the MGs. So it's this kind of combination of really cool rhythm, but then you're wailing on those organs, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. The B3 is central to what we do.
That's right. And again, that rhythm, I think, really kind of locks everything in. And the band that you've assembled here, you have some really talented musicians. And tell us the story of this, because you formed a few years ago over at Fitzgerald's, where you're doing this record release show. Tell us how you came together.
Well, John Fournier, our sax player, and I had been playing in another band for a while and really enjoyed it. That kind of fell by the wayside, and we had sort of a break of a little while that we were saying, we got to get something back together to do stuff that's a little bit more along the lines of what we enjoy doing. You know, everybody in the band is working a lot. They're all top call guys, but we've all been friends through different channels for years and had kind of been looking for a way to do things. And actually this thing started at when COVID hit. There was obviously a dearth of live music. There was nowhere to play, but up in Evanston at the Post 42 VFW hall on the golf course there, they were starting to do some music on their patio outside. And the guy who runs the place, Mike Hughes, is a friend of mine. And he reached out and said, hey, do you want to do something there? And I thought, yeah, everybody wants to do something right now. So I thought about it and thought, this is our opportunity. So I called John and we decided, yeah, let's assemble some guys. And it was kind of lucky. Everybody was available because nobody was working at the time. And we got to really stretch out and develop it. We went through a couple of different iterations. And then when things opened back up, we moved back over to Fitzgerald's, and Will Duncan over there has been a huge supporter and friend of ours, and kind of gave us a steady for every month. I think it's the third Friday every month we play, and gave us a chance to really develop the sound and get to really, really know each other. Even though we'd all played together, you know, whenever you put a bunch of different musicians in a cauldron like that, things start to, you know, to blend and grow into their own thing. So it was really fortunate. You know, we had the luck. I grabbed John Paul, our bass player, who I've been playing with in Trib for 25 years, and Kevin Brunson on drums, who's kind of a patriarch of the West Side gospel scene. He was, you know, his father, Milton Brunson, is a legend in that scene. And I would say Kevin is too. And then Fran Banish, who, you know, I had done a lot of work with in the Freddie Jones band and playing with the Bono brothers and some other stuff. And he's just a legend in his own right on the blues scene here. You know, we all kind of talked about it and got together, and it just gelled right away. And these guys are, in addition to being incredible players, they're incredible people. And it's really, we just have a lot of fun together and kind of did it for the love of it, and are still doing it for the love of it. But as it developed, we're like, oh, there's something special here. We should maybe do something with this. So here we are.
Here we are. And the self-titled record from the Meadowlark Lemons comes out this Friday, the same day as the record release show at Fitzgerald's in Berwyn. And, yep. You know, when you listen to this record, I think it's just fun. You know, it's you can tell you guys are having fun with this. The music is upbeat and it's soulful. It's powerful. it's so much fun. So, you know, with, in terms of this record, what you were trying to do, I know you've got this funk soul thing going on, but tell us about what you were angling for here with this debut record.
I mean, part of it was we wanted to capture some of the energy and the magic that happens when we play live. So when we did record the record, we did it at King Size Studios live in the room. We played just like we do on stage. We didn't do a lot of overdubs, just vocals and stuff that we couldn't do live in the room. But everything else is kind of us going to town the way we normally do. And I think that worked. When I listen to the record, I hear a lot of that in there. There's a lot of fun going on.
And the song I was listening to earlier, Meet Me at the Sidebar, is that talking about the sidebar at Fitzgerald's? It's got to be, right?
It absolutely is. It absolutely is.
It's a great tune.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, we love that one. It's been, you know, that place has been so important to us. Like I said, developing our sound and who we are and really having the freedom to just kind of experiment and get to where we needed to do. And again, that's, I got to thank Will Duncan for letting us do that. It's really a special place, and not just when we play there. I mean, I frequent there a lot. There is a really interesting stuff going on in there, and it's just a cool little percolator of music in town. We liked it enough that we thought, well, let's write a song about it, and there it was. So.
We're in the spot where things get hot. It's time to let your hair go down. It's when you're in the sidebar, you're in the best party in town. Meet me at the sidebar.
That's amazing. And Will Duncan, yeah, the owner of Fitzgerald's, he is great. I did my 1,000th show of this show at Fitzgerald's, and
oh wow,
that kind of came together over our kids were playing together at a Halloween party, and I said, hey, Will, I need somewhere to do the 1,000th show. I love Fitzgerald's. Can we do it there? And he's like, yeah, cool. And that's kind of the vibe. You know, like, there's so many great, amazing, talented people that really come together around that space in particular, because it's not just a venue. I mean, it is a campus. There are multiple stages and things like that, but it's a community hub. And I think we need more of that in Chicago, you know?
100%. And you're right. It is a community. It's you know, there's a lot of interplay between a lot of musicians from different parts of the musical spectrum, which creates some super interesting stuff.
And Fitzgerald's is, again, the home of this record release show. It's this Friday, March 27th, 8:30 p.m. show. Tell us what's coming up.
Well, obviously we're going to play through all the tracks on the record and a bunch of other good stuff. We have a few kind of brand new ones in the hopper that we put together just for this show. And it's going to be a party. So I encourage everybody to come out. There'll be a lot of great playing. It'll be fun. And the one thing about the Lemons is when we play, you know, everybody's smiling in the room. It's always a good time.
That's the name of the game, man. It is feel-good music. Everyone's going to have a great time. We could check out the website, MeadowlarkLemons.com. And the Meadowlark Lemons will be performing their debut album this Friday at Fitzgerald's in Berwyn. That's an 8:30 p.m. show. Really quickly here, Chris, any Tributosaurus gigs coming up?
We do have a few things coming up, but we haven't announced anything. I wish I had something to give you, but look for us to be in a couple of different places over April and May, and then the summer's very busy. We got a lot of fests and a bunch of other shows, but a lot of good stuff coming there.
Right on. The band is the Meadowlark Lemons. Check out MeadowlarkLemons.com. Chris Neville is the vocalist, and he plays keys in that local group, and they are really, really good. Chris, thanks for talking to us today. Congrats on this new project, the new music, and it's going to be a great show Friday night.
Thanks, Mike. I really appreciate it.
Access to fresh, healthy food is not a given in Chicago. According to the website ChicagoHealthOnline.com, which is a local health journalism website, quote, a 2020 Chicago Department of Public Health study shows that within 26 of Chicago's 77 community areas, 25% or more of residents faced food insecurity, primarily concentrated on the south and west sides. Overall, approximately 12% of Cook County residents face food insecurity, but the rate is higher in Chicago proper at around 20%, according to the Greater Chicago Food Depository. End quote. Food deserts, areas that lack access to healthy food, have serious adverse health risks for their residents, residents that are primarily people of color. The film Edible Eats, which is available on Tubi and Amazon Prime, came out last year and is set in Chicago. It imagines a world where food in Black communities becomes scarce and is meant to be a reminder that the food consumed in underserved neighborhoods across America has an impact on our future. The writer, director, and producer of that film is Daryl Manuel, and he is here with us on Outside the Loop today. Daryl, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having us.
You got it. And Phil Lee is also here. He's a producer of the film Edible Eats. Phil, nice to talk to you.
Oh, great to be here. Thank you so much.
You got it. So, Daryl, I'll start with you. The film story here, I want you to talk a little bit about this, because this kind of imagines a future where, you know, some stuff, it's a little sci-fi in there, I guess. Stuff goes on. There's an outbreak. Food supply is scarce. Set the scene for us. What's this film all about?
I will do. I originally started writing this movie when it seemed like every moment on the news or you hear about something, there was always some shooting, some violent crime has happened. And a lot of my friends would say, hey, Daryl, if I come to Chicago, am I going to need a bulletproof vest?
Right.
And of course I would say no, but you know, we look at our own selves and we step out our doors, are we, you know, very comfortable, or is our head always on a swivel? And that made me think that what if it's not a coincidence, but maybe it's a reason why everyone is acting so violent and seems to be getting more violent. And that's what made me start to write this movie, that in the not too distant future, where our normal food sources are no longer available and a food revolution is taking place, where genetically modified designer foods are now the thing to eat. And Edible Eats is a Black-owned fast food franchise that people love and it's very delicious. But as the movie opens, they're under investigation because they think their food is designed to make people addictive. And under the threat of them closing it down, Congress closing them down until they know. Of course, everyone rushes to get some, to get one last taste before they do, including our three heroes who discover a terrifying secret, and now getting some Edible Eats could be their last meal.
Well, that's quite the tease about the story of this film, Edible Eats. Again, it's available on Tubi, T-U-B-I, and Amazon Prime. So, okay, we got the story, a little bit of the background, kind of the plot context there. Let's talk about, you know, why this film was made and what you want people to take away from it. Overall, what is the message of this film? Because it sounds like there's a little sci-fi in there. There is some comedy. There's comedy horror in there, too.
Thriller,
action stuff. Right. So what do you want people to kind of take from this film?
Ideally, that if you knew you were being a lab rat, and you say, hey, there's an experiment going on. I'm a lab rat and it's making me violent. Would you change your mind about being violent and choose another path and say, I'm not going to participate in that anymore. I'll put my guns down and not terrorize the people in my neighborhood because I'm being provoked and designed to do it. So that is the main question that I wanted to ask and make people think about.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because, you know, Daryl and I, you know, we started in advertising and we've done a lot of work with a lot of Chicago ad agencies. And our main thing was directing and editing commercials. And then when we started, you know, we were just like, let's try writing. Let's see if we can kind of do some long format feature work. And, you know, Daryl starts writing, you know, this story. And as he was writing it, like all of these things were coming out about genetically modified food. And then we had that one incident where everybody was going crazy over these chicken sandwiches from Popeye's Chicken. So it was supposed to kind of be reality. But as he's writing it and as we're kind of getting ready to do this, So many things in life were actually reflecting what was happening in our story, which made it even more, you know, kind of realistic as from a connection standpoint. So that's kind of how we, as we were going down this journey, we kind of saw like some real life things happening, which was pretty amazing.
Right. I remember the Popeyes stuff, the craze that was going on there not yeah. too long ago. So, you know, I began this conversation kind of framing it with what's going on with food and food availability. And in Chicago, like I said, that is not a guarantee. There are some communities in the city that are considered food deserts. Again, these are areas that are really lacking access to healthy food. So this film, how does that connect to what's going on? Because I said, you know, these food deserts are typically happening in underserved communities, and there's an overlap there with this racial issue, those being primarily people of color and African-American specifically. How does all that connect together?
You know, it's said statistically, for every 1% increase in food insecurity, violent crime raises by 12%. So they're kind of hand in hand. And they're very much hand in hand, where it's no surprise then in these areas being affected by food deserts, they're also high violent crime areas at the same time. When I was searching for a motif, kind of a horror story motif to write this movie in, and I looked at the zombie movies, and it was always, hey, don't go over there. Some zombies over there. Hey, you got somebody over here. Watch out when you walk over here. I always look around. I said, wait a minute. That sounds like my neighborhood. When I, when I'm walking around, I'm looking around over here. My head is on a swivel. And that's what made me gravitate toward that motif, because we all kind of, it's sad that when we step out of our homes, our main hope is that everything, I get back to my home, and that everything is still there when I get there.
Yeah. And Phil, I want to ask you that same question, because what we're talking about here, that motif that Daryl is discussing, this is really something that you can apply to modern Chicago, can't you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's really unfortunate that, like, you know, in certain areas on the South and West Side where people who probably make less money and have less resources have to drive further and have to pay more to get food. And, you know, if there's not a good, you know, grocery store in your neighborhood, if it's just the typical fried fast food restaurants, you're spending more. And, you know, like it's just less on your health. And unfortunately, there's nothing you can do about that. If you live in that area, you're going to pay more for food that is bad for you. So it's just kind of one of those things that, like, nobody really wants to talk about. But, like, you know, I think that maybe it's not purposeful, but, like, there's something about the fact that we're not actively trying to do better for our underserved communities. So,
yeah. And I'm also thinking how when there maybe is a larger grocery store, a private grocery store that goes into one of these underserved communities, maybe it lasts a little while. You know, I think we saw this with, I don't know if it was a Whole Foods or one of those big
Whole Foods.
Yeah, bigger stores.
And Walmart.
Yeah. And Walmart, right. So these areas or these stores go in these areas and then they leave. And it's like, well, wait a second. What's going on here? Why, you know, why would this happen? Is that something you're thinking about, too, with this whole story of the film?
Yeah. You know, I remember when Whole Foods came in, Whole Foods, I thought the CEO at the time was specifically saying we're bringing this Whole Foods to the South Side because we're trying to address like this food desert. So it wasn't like you were coming to the South Side because you knew you were going to make money. I thought he was coming to really help out the community. So it was really disheartening when they closed. And, you know, I've seen Targets like kind of close on the South Side and then these Great Lands that this super mega Target. So there's just this constant thing where, like, for whatever reason, and I don't think it's about money. I think we'll pay for food just like anybody else. So, you know, it's always a question as to why we're just not getting the same kind of opportunities to get good food as other neighborhoods.
Yeah. And Daryl, I want to give you a chance to respond to that too. Just thinking about kind of the feeling around food and the relationship between the residents of these areas, in this case, in certain areas of Chicago, and larger grocery stores. Phil, you were talking about some of the animosity, I guess, or the uneasiness that exists there. Like, hey, you're going to stay here. You're going to help us out because we're willing to pay. Do you share in what Phil was saying, Daryl?
Well, it seems that food deserts and lack of economic development in those same areas go hand in hand. Consequently, people, if they aren't able to get the resources and to have the job opportunities in those areas, and they are under the stress of having to feed their family, not everyone, but some people may do certain things that they wouldn't normally do. And these are areas that historically have already been under stress, under, you know, the lack of, hey, I'm not going to be able to achieve the American dream. And now I'm under stress and trying to look at what's going on around me. And that stress is felt by all the residents in the neighborhood. I remember the grocery store Walmart on, I think it was 79th and Cottage Grove. And that was a big deal when they came into that area, because that was a major thoroughfare in the city on the south side. But it was definitely, and now since they've closed a few years back, still is a food desert area. And so I applaud these areas on the west side and some on the south side that are opening up these smaller boutique grocery stores, mom and pop stores, but with the main theme of providing fresh fruit and vegetables and meat to those communities that need it really bad.
And this is all tied into the film. Again, it's called Edible Eats, and we should spell it E-D-I-B-L, Edible Eats. And we should remind folks, it's not always super serious. There's some comedy, like we're talking about. There's some, yeah, some scary stuff, some horror stuff in there, I suppose. But, you know, this is it's a serious message, but I think the story can have some light areas to it. So all in all, when we think about why to see this film, give us that pitch. Why do you want people to see this film? Phil, I'll start with you.
Yeah, you know, there was obviously the other thing that was kind of happening is as Daryl is kind of writing it and prepping this film, you know, doing research, you know, you find out that there are more lobbyists in Washington for food than anything else. Not the NRA, not WEP. It's food, because it's the one thing that everybody does probably 2 to 3 times a day. So, you know, when you hear about these stories about how, you know, they were able to legally dye meat because they just felt like they were losing too much money. So the things that are going into food, like, we know that those things are not good. The preservatives and all of these things, they're not good for us. But, like, you know, nobody's going to spend the time to read that paragraph of ingredients of things that we can't pronounce. So the fact that we are addicted to food is just the reality. And the reality is we sometimes like to believe that these companies are doing right by us, but they're just trying to make a profit in a lot of cases. So this whole thing about this red sauce that is going on the food in this restaurant is basically addictive, and it's also violent. And, you know, it was supposed to be kind of more fiction, but as we did more research, we start to realize that we're basically addicted to food. And we don't like to think about it like that, but we are literally addicted to food. And so this was kind of a movie that was kind of trying to, and with all the action and the humor and the horror, there's that underlying theme that we have that hopefully people can kind of start to realize after they watch this movie.
The film is called Edible Eats, E-D-I-B-L-E-A-T-S, Edible Eats. It is available now on Tubi, the streaming platform, T-U-B-I, and Amazon Prime. And it's set in Chicago, and a couple of Chicago guys behind it. Daryl Manuel is the writer, producer, and director of Edible Eats, and Phil Lee is a producer of this film. Guys, I really appreciate this conversation. It's a big issue. I'm glad you're out there tackling it with your art and getting this message out here. And thanks for the time today.
Hey, thank you, Mike, for giving us
Thank you
time
so much, Mike. Yeah, this is great.
To reach your audience. And audience, please go see this movie and join the fight.
And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 1014 is done. Thank you very much for listening to the show today. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for all of his wonderful engineering skills in the WGN radio studio. I hope you have a wonderful week. I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.